This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now we are entering our third year, just about to anyway, of the coronavirus pandemic. It's been an experience like nothing we've ever had before. It has been extremely traumatic. Almost 6,000 people have died in Ireland. Many others have been seriously ill. And of course, for people working in the health service, it has been a terribly trying time. Frontline workers, many of whom have got sick themselves, are really exhausted, and that applies to everyone from porters to all the support staff to people in intensive care units. It's been a terrible time, and there has been much talk in media and elsewhere and many opinions. And of course, at a moment like this, the very best journalists come to the fore, and in my opinion, one of the very best in this crisis and during this pandemic has been Rachel Lavin, who's working for the Sunday Business Post. Her stuff is brilliant, fact-based, well-researched, informed and objective. She studies the data, not just from Ireland, but from elsewhere. And yesterday in the Business Post, along with her colleague Daniel Murray, Rachel laid out in well-written, accessible style a long piece that told us more or less everything that we needed to know. The headline, "Are We Nearly There Yet?" which is a cry that many children have made and asked their parents. So I begin, Rachel, thank you very much for joining us on The Stand. Are we nearly there yet?
It's a good question. So I think the first thing I'll say when we talk about the end, this isn't the first time we've talked about the end. So it always comes with a pinch of salt. I think if I can pull up from some stats from you, actually, basically, the public are actually less optimistic, or they were.
Yes, you made that point yesterday. Yes.
Yeah, so basically, Amoric does these weekly polls of optimism in the public. And because we've thought it was the end so many times, they've been optimistic so many times. The first time was 56% of the public thought the worst of the crisis is behind us in June 2020. Think back to June 2020, we were told all we needed to do was flatten that curve. And at the time, NPHET had models telling us zero cases by September. And do you remember the talk at the time that summer that if we can just flatten this curve,
yes,
you know, winter this out, we can summer anywhere. And that was the big hope for that summer. Obviously, that didn't go to plan. The wave began again. It began in particular counties. It began growing then. We were meant to have a phased reopening with 500 people events by September, but instead we started reimposing levels. We went through the level in September and Christmas. So it got to them. We had the Christmas wave, which was really devastating. So by May, people were vaccinated. They were feeling optimistic again, and 68% thought the worst was behind us. But if you check the data then, obviously a lot has happened since last May. The Delta wave, the ongoing high number of cases, then this Christmas, then Omicron. So people now were only about 30% were feeling that the worst was behind us when surveyed. I think it was either 1 or 2 weeks ago. And that might have changed. There's a new survey coming out. It gets published every Monday or Tuesday. But yeah, people are still frightened. And I think they're so beaten down that they're afraid to be optimistic. There's a great analogy used by Gabriel Scali, who's been a good, I think he's been a good voice on the issue a lot of the time. He obviously did the cervical check inquiry, and he's a professor of public health in the University of Bristol. And the one thing that he said to me all along was, be wary of the Stockdale paradox. So this is this theory of optimism and pessimism. And a lot of time when you're reporting on this, you get accused of being too optimistic or too pessimistic. But to me, optimism and pessimism, it's a bias, right? If you're trying to be optimistic or pessimistic, it is a bias that informs your reporting, and it's a thing you kind of need to try and avoid. Best thing is to be realistic. This is how Scali explains it. So James Stockdale, a former Vietnam prisoner of war for 8 years, he claimed it was, basically he was in a prison camp in Vietnam for 8 years, and he said it was the optimists who didn't survive because of their continued false belief that they would be out by Christmas.
Yes.
He said it was those who had the faith that they would prevail in the end and the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality that survived. So he always kind of said, we need to be realistic. That all that said, and all that caution aside, I personally am very optimistic, and I spoke to lots of doctors on the front line. I looked at the data for the Omicron wave. We spoke to Dave Nabarro, the WHO's COVID, he's the chief envoy or special envoy on COVID-19. And he is also feeling very optimistic.
In his case, he said, as you point out in your piece with Daniel Murray yesterday, a few weeks ago, he said he had never been more concerned about the arrival of Omicron.
Neither was I as well. I mean, I think 4 weeks ago, when the news of Omicron came off, I was at a music festival. I was at Other Voices in Kerry. I was trying to switch off for a few days, and I was trying to actually socialize for the first proper time in the pandemic. And then the following week I was sick. So the following week I was going through the data from South Africa, and I felt so ill the next day. I had to go to bed with a migraine for a good few hours looking at this data. Because when you looked at the data on how many people would get infected and you multiplied out that exponential growth over the next few weeks, I could see in early December, when everyone was thinking we were going to have a normal Christmas, that everybody, almost everybody, could be infected in a month in the new year. And that hasn't completely come to pass. I'd say it's probably about a third or a fifth of people who've been infected by now with Omicron. But I just remember being so terrified, because at the time we weren't sure if the mildness or the reduced severity data would play out. So I was totally with Nabarro at that stage. I was really freaked out. I think sometimes people think journalists, they get mad at us for delivering the news. Sometimes we get anger on Twitter. But I feel the same when I first find it out. And you kind of have this weird phase where you kind of know things a bit before people. So I was telling all my friends, go home before Christmas or you'll be isolating in Dublin, that kind of thing. So I was with Nabarro. I thought this was going to be really, really bad, looking at transmissibility, but it's the severity. And we've just found out the severity. It depends on each country's immunity. They're calling it a wall of immunity in some places. And in Ireland, we seem to have done really well. The worst seems to have passed with the Omicron wave in terms of cases. The cases are falling. And I think Nabarro, he's saying, you know, Omicron is less severe. If different countries have big walls of immunity, they can see these case numbers come down. They can get through this. He's not saying it's going to be easy. It's going to be over by February. But he's saying if we can get through Omicron wave, it'll be a bumpy road to the end of this pandemic, or it won't be a smooth one. It'll be bumpy, but he seems to think the end is in sight.
Yes, and you quote him as saying that the process between being a nasty pandemic and being an endemic with a milder virus is never a smooth one. It's going to be quite a bumpy few months. And there is another important quote from the piece you did yesterday. It's a quote from Gabriel Scali, who I agree with you has been very good, very succinct and very rigorous, as he indeed was in the cervical health check business. He says, and I quote, "The chances of us getting herd immunity with the existing vaccines alone are non-existent." And there was this thought, and you raised this in your piece, that we might reach a form of herd immunity. And that appears, and what's happening in Britain, as I'm sure you've looked at it, it's chaotic and political, but one of their objectives was achieving herd immunity by letting this thing rip through the population. And indeed, Boris Johnson is suggesting as recently as 24 hours ago that they may remove all restrictions very soon.
Yeah. So here's the thing with herd immunity. Herd immunity was always a bit controversial to some scientists. Gabriel Scali said he never believed it would work. So herd immunity is when enough people are immune and protected that it can't get through, that the herd can protect the vulnerable. And we have a small population in Ireland of really, really vulnerable people who can't necessarily get the benefit of vaccine. That's blood cancer patients, particularly if they've had a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant. Yes. That's transplants, organ transplant patients, people on immunosuppressants, immunocompromised. We have to protect those people. And we also just want to protect, we wanted to protect almost everyone from getting this if we could. So the idea was, get the immunity through infection, or sorry, through injection. Injection or infection was the choice. Get the immunity through vaccination. And that's what we, like, a lot of people thought this was really possible last June with vaccination, the whole idea of vaccination. We're going to reach this promised land. Again, by September, we'll have zero cases. That was what NEPA projected last May or June. And basically, to get herd immunity, you need a certain level of transmissibility from the virus, a certain percentage there. Then there's another calculation with the percentage protection from infection the vaccine gives you. So you'll notice when people talk about vaccine efficacy, they're always telling you protection against symptomatic infection as the main marker for how effective that vaccine is. So you need that percentage and the transmissibility of the variant. So at the time last May, I think the vaccine was, they were saying it was like Pfizer, it was like 90% protection against symptomatic infection. And then we knew that the variant was, I can't remember exactly, a certain percentage transmissible. So if you put those two sums together, we knew that we needed to get about 75% of the public vaccinated. And you'll remember all last year, Micheál Martin saying, we are going to get 80% of the population vaccinated with a first dose. And then it later kind of changed to the offer of a first dose by this date in June. And then we will have a great summer, because they thought they were going to hit a threshold. That was what I was reading between the lines. They thought they were going to hit the magic herd immunity threshold. It never came, and it never came because of Delta. Again, it was one of those moments for me where I was so, so depressed by it for the whole month of June, because when we heard the early data, Delta, I think we heard it in May, and it didn't really become dominant here till July. And I just remember everybody was talking about the end of the pandemic, and I was looking at the statistics. The statistics are telling us that level of transmissibility, remember, it was more transmissible. Yes. And then the vaccines, it came out in a study really early on from London. And it almost didn't get that reported on, that it would reduce the efficacy. I think it was only about maybe 5 or 10%. But we knew then, looking purely at the statistics, we weren't going to get to herd immunity, because we would need, in that case, with those new statistics, I think we found out in May, 90%, 87 to 90%.
Yes.
Protection from vaccination. And there was an argument at the time, the government seemed to think, oh, it's only the adults that need this. Because kids are kind of naturally immune. But I always thought it was the full population. And we were never, even the most vaccine enthusiastic country in the world, we were never going to get that protection from vaccination. And now we've got Omicron, really much more transmissible again, much more vaccine evasive. We're just not going to get herd immunity from vaccination.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Let me ask you some specific questions, Rachel. Where is Delta now? Is Omicron pushing it out the door?
Yes, I think so. There's been talk of a twindemic, but in Ireland, Omicron is counting now for about, I think, 95 to 97% of cases. Delta just dying out. Now, a lot of our ICU patients are still Delta, but some people are saying they'll keep going together. I kind of not really seen that in Ireland, at least. I think we are about, we're basically Omicron is dominant and Delta is next to nothing of our cases.
That's important because of the severity of Delta as opposed to what is believed to be the relatively milder Omicron.
Exactly. I learned a really useful way of thinking about variants early on in the pandemic. It was that the most transmissible variant will become dominant. So yes, the more transmissible it is, it'll just beat out all the other guys and it will become dominant. And I think that's why people are enthusiastic about Omicron and less severe variants, because they're hopeful these more transmissible variants that strive to survive will make themselves less severe as they evolve, because they obviously, if you kill your host, it's no use to use a variant. The variant dies with it. And these viruses have this obviously same instinct as the rest of us living things. This instinct to survive will try to be more transmissible, and it makes sense for them to evolve into less severe. Now, talking about sense and variance evolution probably doesn't, it's not the best thing, but the hope is that you get less and more and more transmissible, less and less severe over time. That's what Nambaro has said. But yeah, basically, the more transmissible variant, I remember speaking to scientists about this early on, and I had an evil genius plan. Why don't we just make highly transmissible COVID that causes no deaths, which is probably a sort of biological warfare. But you know, it is possible that a transmissible variant that reduces severity is the way that this ends, or at least becomes tolerable. And Nambaro has said that he and his WHO colleagues think that Omicron is the start of this journey.
Yes, and I mean, the Spanish flu is instructive in that regard, and most of us, or all of us virtually, weren't around at that point. There are four scenarios that you lay out in your piece yesterday with Daniel Murray as to where we go from here. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. So, four scenarios. When we talk about the end, it's not like done and dusted over next month situation.
Yeah.
We're kind of reaching the end. We're nearing the end. But what does the end look like? So, four scenarios are cases rise like NEFA projected, and they did peak when NEFA projected there last week, falling drastically. They think it's going to fall really dramatically. You could be down to below 10,000 by the end of this month, below 1,000 a day by the end of February, below 100 a day by March. That's what their projection shows, and that's the one where our cases most align with. That would be amazing. Imagine less than 100 cases by March. Now, Neffet Ham said, we don't expect it to necessarily follow the model, It could grumble along at a higher rate. So I don't know if higher rate is 500, 5,000 like we had before Christmas. But essentially, you're going to see a flatlining for the rest of the year with winter surges. The idea being, first scenario becomes like flu. It is mild throughout the year. It surges in the winter with the other respiratory viruses. We boost coming into the winter months like a flu vaccine. And we just exist with it. We get on with it. It doesn't hurt us as much.
At that point, it's endemic and possibly you get a vaccine like you get a flu vaccine at the moment.
That's a really, really hopeful, it's a really optimistic scenario. But that's a best case scenario. But as you know, this pandemic, that doesn't always happen. Here's another reality. And this is, again, just taking Omicron on its own, which probably won't be the case for the most of this year. But let's just say if Omicron keeps going. The problem with Omicron is nobody's had it longer than, what, a month or 2 months? It yes. came in last November. And there's been a few reports that people who've had Delta before reinfected after yes. 3 months. And so if 3 months is the bar, what if with Omicron, what if you get reinfected after 3 months? What if everybody who got infected in January gets infected again in March and again yes. in March, April, May, June, and again every 3 months? What if we go through waves over and over again of reinfection? That's a concern. That's one I have been worried about. What if this keeps back over and over? Yes. And I think the theory there is that if it kept reinfecting you, but you had been previously infected, it would be less severe each time. So maybe you'll get like a less severe wave each time. But obviously then the potential for variants with that level of spread, I mean, it would also just be very stressful, right? To see numbers climbing every few months in these surges. So nobody wants to see that, but that could happen. We need to figure out the reinfection rate for this virus, and we need to watch South Africa. If you see numbers going up in South Africa who had it first, then we're going to be worried. If it yes. happens maybe every 6 months, it could be tolerable, but hopefully every year your immunity will last. You'll get boosted before it wanes. Immunity, how long it lasts from infection, is going to be a big, big thing. I should just say, I said to you that herd immunity by vaccination wasn't possible, which is obviously an upsetting thing to hear because I think a lot of the public still hope for it. But herd immunity from infection could yes. still happen. Yes. So I said vaccination, not immunity, couldn't get us there because vaccinations weren't strong enough. The third scenario brings in the question of variants. So Dr. Brian Kent, who's a respiratory consultant in James's, one of the forefronts of, you know, the pandemic in yes. the centre of Dublin, he said, we will have a new variant and we'll have it soon. He goes, there's no doubt. Look how quickly Omicron came on the scene. So he's pretty confident we will see one in the next few months. If not weeks, who knows with this thing, right? So the question
the key to new variants is the spread of infections exactly. in populations, the amount of COVID that's around.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, all it takes is one person. It can take one person who's immunocompromised. Maybe they've had a bone marrow transplant. Maybe they've got HIV. And when it stays in their system for a long time, that's when it can evolve. It can also go from humans to animals and back again. I'm not an epidemiologist, but that's how I understand it. So it can take one freak event. I've even had one scientist describe it to me that a person could develop an extremely lethal variant in their system, but it could die with them. So who knows what variants have been out there that have died within the patient. But yeah, it's a little scary to think about the possibilities for these variants. But I've narrowed it down to two. The first one is we get a less dangerous variant. That idea that the variant evolves, it's more and more transmissible, but less and less severe. And that's really what you'd happen. You'd hope what happened with Omicron happens again. Omicron 2.0 or whatever is next in the Greek alphabet. And you get a less and less severe. Maybe even, you know, if it's the same level of transmissibility, but you just see less severity. That would be the dream. That's what the WHO hope will happen, are quite optimistic will happen. You know, this is the World Health Organization's David Nabarro telling the Business Post. I can pull it up here, but he basically said that he and his colleague are hopeful and enthusiastic that it will follow a course that helps it resemble the common cold.
Yeah, I want to come to that whole idea, Rachel, of, and it's been voiced in Britain a lot, that this, in fact, it's been said by Michael Gove, among others, who's a cabinet minister and a very senior cabinet minister, this is no more dangerous now than the common cold. Let's get on with it. And there's been a lot of ignorant comment and a lot of populism attached to this, which makes your work so refreshingly different because it is based on data. But if serious people, public health experts, are saying that it could reduce to that, that is extremely optimistic. And that's what happened to the Spanish flu, isn't it?
Yeah, I spoke to Gabriel Scali about the Spanish flu, and he said what happened to the Spanish flu was it was really bad for about 2 years, 1918 to 1920. But a new variant emerged that jumped a couple of evolutionary steps and suddenly was less severe. So Omicron jumped a few steps to be less severe. And he said that's what happened almost, you know, in a much bigger way with the Spanish flu. So that's what the WHO have said. But let me be really, really clear when we talk about it becoming like a common cold. What Nabarro said was to get to that point, needs to happen is that the virus mutates, and in mutating it becomes more transmissible and at the same time less ferocious. He said yes. The arrival of Omicron suggests the journey has started, but there are a few caveats to this. He goes, it's going to be a bumpy next few months. So he's not saying we're there yet.
What does bumpy look like, Rachel?
So it could be like that first scenario I described where the second scenario where we get these reinfection rates. The yes. other scenario, he said, so the fourth scenario I'm going to outline for you now is the variant gets worse. That is the fear. That is the scariest yes. reality, that the variant evolves with the transmissibility of yes. Omicron and the severity of Delta. This thing we were all terrified of early December when we looked at the numbers. If you had the level of spread now with Delta, I mean, the numbers, the hospitals would be completely overwhelmed. Yes. And that's why people were really cautious when they first saw this, because a lot of people were saying it's mild. And we shouldn't say that either. It's milder, but it's still yes. a scary variant. It's still a scary virus. So the fear is it could get worse. And Delta was more severe than Alpha. So it is possible that you go back yes. a step and you get a more severe variant. And here's So the question is to that is we don't know if we will get a more severe variant. All we can do is sit tight and watch. But for whatever reasons, WHO are saying that they're optimistic. They're saying that we do think we will see a potentially more lethal variant emerge. But they said that they think it won't become dominant. Coming back to that issue of transmissibility, he said, we think it's pretty unlikely that a virus that is more lethal will become dominant. We do think that there will be more lethal variants that will emerge, and they will be associated with unpleasantness in localized situations. But they won't become dominant unless all of our predictions are wrong.
Let me ask you about the unvaccinated. There are about, I think, 200,000 people. Is it 200,000? Rachel, you'd know probably more precisely than me. There are a couple of 100,000 people in Ireland who are unvaccinated. And in fact, I think it was, well, I'm not sure where I saw. It was in the Sunday Times. Two of those people were prepared to go public and say, and they weren't sort of crazed people. They were in their own minds rational and making rational arguments. What threat do the unvaccinated, let's suppose we get to the benign scenarios you've outlined. What threat then do the unvaccinated pose to the rest of us?
So sometimes I think we are too, dare I say, and this is controversial, too hard on the unvaccinated. We have to expect a certain number of people aren't going to take this vaccine.
Yes.
We are not a perfect society. To get to the level we've had, 90% of adults, that's the golden, you know, that's the goal.
Yes.
That's what every other country is aiming for. So what do we want to get? 95% vaccinated, 100% vaccinated? Why? Because we're not aiming for herd immunity by vaccination anymore. We think it will come more likely from natural immunity if we get it at all. So why do we want these people to get vaccinated? Do you think they're more likely to give you COVID? And I remember this being a thing around Callum Robinson, the football player, saying he should be put yes. in other changing rooms and he's going to infect the team, blah, blah, blah. And I thought that was a bit overblown. Now, there is more, I do think there is more of a likelihood with transmission in an unvaccinated person than a vaccinated person. But you have to remember that even if you're vaccinated, you're only 50% protected at the time. This was last August, I think. Your ability to stop symptomatic infection had gone down to about 50, 60%. And this is pre-boosters, to be fair.
Yes.
But you're still likely to transmit it if you're vaccinated, and you should still assume that you're a risk. So I just felt at the time that people were acting like it was only the unvaccinated who could spread this virus. And that's yes. not true. We live in a reality where vaccinated people can spread this virus. And I do think the protection against symptomatic infection has come up to about 88% with Omicron plus Pfizer booster, but at this, or at least, you know, 70, 75% with the correct figure, sorry, is 70 to 75%, depending on whether you've got AstraZeneca or Pfizer as your first dose. But that's still 1 in 4 chance of you getting the virus and passing it on to someone. So I just think we've been very hard on the unvaccinated people in terms of transmission. I think if you're unvaccinated, the biggest risk you pose is to yourself. You were taking yes. on that personal risk that you think you're going to get COVID and you're going to be just fine and dandy. But it's a free country. If you want to do that, you are going to pay the price. It's literally your funeral. Like, that yes. is the risk you take. And if you refuse to listen to the science on this, or you refuse to just not get it, it's their choice to do that. It's a bad choice. But I don't think we can force these people. The only risk they do pose to the rest of us, the real risk, other than transmission, which I think is overblown, is that they take up critical hospital beds, they yes. take up critical infrastructure in our hospitals. They are public health hospital beds. They are all our beds. And it is, like, it's annoying when someone says, I'm going to take a risk here that could end up me taking up an ICU bed. Particularly when we looked into the wave that we thought we could have had with Omicron, those people would have been a big problem. They would have taken up a lot of ICU beds. And it's still a problem, even though we haven't been overwhelmed and we seem to be cresting in hospitalizations, hopefully. That data is still coming through, but it looks pretty good that we are going to see a fall in the next few days. Those people are still taking up beds they could have avoided. And that is what the threat they pose to the public. That's why people should be annoyed, because they're taking right. up beds. But I will say, the people who don't get vaccinated, you know, they're victims too, in another way. They're victims of misinformation. And there was a great piece in The Independent yesterday about a woman who lost her husband, who felt she'd been used. Well, do we look at them as villains, or maybe just people who are terribly misguided and they're victims of misinformation? And they've put themselves at risk. It's hard to feel anger. We do have a really high vaccination rate. So these people exist in every society. They exist in ours too.
Now, there was a time, and it's not long ago, when Dr. Tony Holohan was very much against antigen testing. And now it seems, from the piece you wrote for the Sunday Business Post with Daniel Murray yesterday, that we will move to an antigen test only system. And the PCR testing, which is more reliable, as I understand it, will be phased out. Is that a cost issue, convenience issue, and is it safe?
Well, I think they're still going to take an element of PCR testing, particularly for high risk and healthcare workers. But yeah, it's a difficult issue. I think it comes to sort of it's a cumulative cost benefit, or at least so at the time when we were trying to keep numbers really low, one false antigen was enough to cause a cluster that would be a significant portion of cases.
Yes.
And that was a worry because the variant was more severe then. So at the time they were like, we can't afford one false antigen to cause a cluster, because people, or, you know, 10 false antigens, you know, false positives.
Of course, yes.
But that has shifted now, because there's so many cases that the benefit of the antigens in picking them up when they can't be PCR test outweighs the risks of you know, and a potential false antigen, you've also got a less severe variant. So one false positive, if someone's asymptomatic and it's not being picked up with Omicron, they're less of a risk to the rest of society. So we have seen this move toward antigen testing. I mean, it would have been nicer to see it a bit sooner.
Yeah.
I think our public health team have been, you know, they've been very good. Our public health response has been very good.
Indeed. Thank you very much for joining us on Stan. That's Rachel Lavin, who has been doing outstanding work on the COVID pandemic for the Business Post. And we're very grateful to Rachel, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.